This is Mark Larson. The tape ministry should start rolling any minute now, and then we'll get going. I forgot to give them ample warning. There will be more people coming in, but by way of introduction, let me read this quote to you, because I think it typifies what us photographers struggle with, and that is that the rare moment is not the moment when there is something worth looking at, but the moment when we are capable of seeing. I think we struggle a lot as photographers and as people walking around. And I told the story coming up here, I was expecting different types of images, aspen glowing and all those kinds of things. Instead, I'm seeing smaller things, but I had put myself in the wrong moment. I wasn't ready to see what was. Now that I'm ready and slow down a little, I'm really enjoying myself. I have a few handouts here as well. Come on in, please.
Is this the other one too?
Right. And it's not the other one yet, Hugh. I'm sorry. It's here, and we'll get to those later. Also, if you hear me or in the handouts, that please don't leave without them tonight. Those of you who were here last time did. I'm referring to this text, The Nature Photographer's Complete Guide to Professional Field Techniques.
Is that written down someplace?
It isn't, but we can. It's okay. There were some copies available in the bookstore, and we'll get a copy.
Just need to get it started.
Right. And the exercises that I'm passing out later tonight are from this book. Our first class meeting, we referred to several ways to improve your work in just 35mm basics. And this is the best technique of all. Have someone in your photo wear a red shirt. I'm not kidding, even though it sounds like something that's humorous. Most of us are shooting color film, but so much of color work looks black and white. It really starts to amaze students in my other work when people put some real serious color in their work. And having people wear something bright like this really sells to the viewer. And if you look at much of the published work with people in it, what are they wearing?
Red color.
Red color. Red reproduces best in magazines and calendars, and on the front cover of most magazines you'll see someone wearing a red shirt. The other things that we're going to talk about quickly and look at some bad shots: shutter speed. Most people use too slow a shutter speed, and the rule to cure that is to use a shutter speed that is the fraction of 1/1 the focal length of your lens. So Jonathan, you're using a 200mm lens. What shutter speed do you have to use to be able to handhold that without causing some shake?
You said 1/1?
A fraction of 1/1 the focal length.
1/200.
Yeah, 1/200 or 1/250, because you don't have a 200. And Rachel, if you're using a 50mm normal lens, what would you have to use?
1/50.
Yeah, except 1/60th is what we have. Do not go below that ever, 1/60th, no matter what the lens, because you will start contributing this. And if you look at your work, a lot of the problems comes from simple blur. Secondly, PhD light meters. Lots and lots of problems, and we're going to look at some slides. Thirdly, besides the red shirt, bracket your exposures, and we'll look at some illustrations of what that means. In most cases, your PhD light meter is turning everything the equivalent of gray, trying to average everything together. And with slides especially, you will improve your work if you bracket, meaning underexpose a half to a full stop from what the light meter says. And we'll see some examples too. And then later, a little bit, we'll get to depth of field. So if someone would assist with the curtains and the lights, we'll begin.
It's going on the hallway.
Those are out in the hallway. I get those.
Oh. I'm not sure what it is.
We're going to look at some examples that illustrate those four or five simple rules other than the red shirt. Now, what has the photographer forgotten to do here?
Composition.
Turn off the water.
Really. Photographer forgot to look through the viewfinder. And frankly, that's really one of the big problems that all of us have with our photography. We fail to look at what we're actually seeing. One of the big, big problems too, in addition to this, is down the middle, is on the edge. You need to look at the edges of your image. See what's sticking in. Your eye will go to the brightest object that's in the scene. And if that's not the focal point, then you've got some problems. Depth of field is an issue here, but your eye will edit out that marvelous tree growing out of her head here. Okay? Your eye will edit out that clump of people, that black edge of the lake, that what I would just refer to as visual garbage behind her. So a quick solution, notice by the way, a backlit portrait, which is a wonderful way to cure the other problems that we have with contrasty light. Always go backlighting in light like we have today. Go for backlighting. Notice her face is in the shadow. So you expose to the shadow area. And in this case, rule number 6 in terms of composition, avoid eye-level photography. It's boring. Get above, get down. Change the perspective, but avoid eye-level photography, especially with your 50mm normal lenses. Some more issues. Notice the poison oak. You don't want to get too close. Rule number 7, or whatever you want to talk about, get closer to your images. Carl and Gibb and I went out on Monday afternoon, and I tried to get them to focus and compose, and then move in. Another step. All of you do that with every photograph you take on this next roll. Look at all that wasted space out there. You're not close enough. There's garbage sticking in. Quickly, lovely color, right? And better composition and all that. But in this case, we have a depth of field problem. Those of you think depth of field, notice the zone of sharpness. See how it softens as we go into the background? Now, in some cases, that's good because it gets rid of the background clutter. But this image, to me, lacks what I saw. My eye is binocular, lots of depth of field. And again, get closer, except in this case, use a telephoto lens. All right, now except for the haircut and the fly being down, what are some problems? Nice steelhead, friend taking the photograph. This is what a lot of work looks like in this contrasty light. What would have been a solution that I already mentioned? Backlighting. And with backlighting, you don't get that washed out color. Also, there's no red shirt. I just thought, what is
backlighting?
Okay, I would be literally turned with the sun striking the back of my head rather than the front, and you would expose for the shadowed area of my face. Notice under my nose and eyes, all that deep shadow. But your brain doesn't see that when you take the photo. Your brain doesn't think about it. It's too harsh an image. It doesn't look like it.
So you'd be actually taking the picture into the sun?
Right. Well, you try to block the sun from your lens somehow. Mm-hmm.
Oh, I see.
And we'll try to demonstrate that.
And then how do you set your exposure factors? If you're using backlight and you turn the other way?
You either walk up to the person a meter close off the shadow and then go back and compose.
All right.
By the way, those of you who were here the other day, notice the latitude problem. I cannot see how the blues are washing out and the shadows are black. Your color film will not achieve rendition of detail and highlight the shadow. And we'll talk about that. Okay, PhD light meter, right?
What's PhD?
Push here, dummy. Oh. All right. I have one of those light meter cameras. And I love it, except for scenes like this, because what does it read?
The water behind it.
Yeah, it averages it all in. And the Grand Canyon is perfectly rendered behind them.
Now, if you go up and meter the faces,
right,
what would happen to the water?
The water, because of the film can't capture that range of brightness to the shadow, will wash out.
No, it's not good though.
Well, it's good if you can see their faces and you have to let the rest go.
Oh, okay.
See, what we're talking about is giving up something as we gain control over the light meter. But this light meter doesn't care about faces that you can't see. The light meter just says, I want to average that whole scene.
Man, not it's right out there.
Yeah. Another cure, by the way. Gib, are you here?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Gib's got an automatic camera with what's called a little fill flash. That would be perfect for this situation here.
Okay.
Fill the shadow area with the flash and let the light meter read the normal situation. The rest of you, you could either use a flash or a aluminum foil or a cookie sheet or whatever and bounce some light in there, but that's a struggle. Okay. By the way, that's the photograph that most of you are getting. Contrasty light, deep shadows, and your light meter is fooling you. Okay, let's look at a bracketing situation. I don't know if this one will go forward and back, but we'll try. Okay, mountain light looks a little dark, underexposed. What? Well, guess what? A little overexposed on the whites. Let's see if we can go back with this. No. So when I say bracketing, your light meter will give you the next shot, typically. The bright, slightly overexposed for the whites in particular. But bracketing means to underexpose slightly and get more intense colors. Look at the reds now. You know, look at the yellows in the flowers. Now this is what a light meter will tell you to shoot. Because it wants the grass and rocks to look kind of gray, normal. What is it, 18% gray? But the whites then disappear. The reds, though, still have some nice tone. Bracketing means shoot maybe what the light meter tells you, and then with color slides, underexpose the half stuff. Full stop. By the way, this is the reverse kind of bracketing. Notice what happens to the flowers as I overexpose a half stop, or maybe even a full stop, for the face. See the backlighting on their faces, everybody? What would my meter tell me? Well, one or two stops under to get the flowers right, but then their faces would be black because of the shadow. So I overrode my light meter and overexpose a half to a full stop to get the shadow detail. By the way, this is what you should do in bright, contrasted light like we had today. Forget the front lighting, the people, with flowers, everything. Go for backlight. Color slides and such. Okay, polarizing filter coming up. Without? With. However, it's also a bad shot because the polarizing filter is too small for this wide-angle lens and blacks out the corners. It's called vignetting. if you use a polarizing filter on a wide-angle lens, you need a couple of millimeter larger polarizing filter. If you see this in your work, that's what's happening. Over-polarizing. Hugh and Carl, remember we were talking about the other day? Over-polarizing of the sky, especially up in the mountains, as you rotate it. And polarizing filters work best at 90 degrees to the sun, all right? The sun, towards the sun or away from the sun, polarizing filters will not darken the sky. But 90 degrees to the direction of the sunlight, either way, you'll get the maximum effect. And this is an error, but it looks kind of nice. Okay, shutter speeds. We're going to look at some examples. Obviously, shutter speeds can freeze action. And by the way, with black and white, you get to do cropping in the darkener, and that's why this is. When on a tripod, or resting your camera on something, a rock, whatever, you can also let action blur through long exposures, ranging from 15th to 8th to fourth to half to 1 second or even longer. Let that water turn into this flow. Most 4x5 photographers, by the way, have this type of flow in their water because their typical exposure time is from an eighth of a second to 20 to 60 seconds. Because 4x5 photographers have exposure problems. They have slow lenses.
They must also have very slow film too, right?
Not necessarily 50, 2500, but
2500?
Right. See, but they want to get lots of depth of field, and a normal lens, which let me save this for later, actually. Normal lens for a 4x5 is 180 millimeters. That's a little beyond what most people want here today.
How fast was that?
That shot was probably an eighth to a half, somewhere in there. Notice this photograph too. With a very slow shutter speed, what do you have to be doing? Up early or late for no wind? And then that background water stream just blurs out. And it was also, because of about a second exposure, I was able to use an F22 for lots of depth of field. Fast shutter speed, right? But the closer something is to you, the faster your shutter speed has to be to freeze the action. This is also a good example of silhouetting, which is a great composition device, and also backlighting. Shutter speed. Notice the person close to me here. I couldn't freeze the action even with 125th, but it's actually kind of an aesthetic touch to have that blur showing the walk up Mount Shasta. This is backlighting, silhouetting, and unfortunately lens flare. If you get too much into the sun, you get a problem that way. By the way, those of you who were here last time, and to teach the new people, share. If you want white snow, what do you have to do to your light meter reading?
Overexpose.
Overexpose what the light meter tells you, or you'll get gray snow. If you want black, what do you have to do from the light meter reading? Underexpose, else you'll get a gray black area. So concentrate on metering off the area that you want in terms of color. Notice the edges, a little light breeze blowing here. It's also fun to let things blur, not only water, but other things. It becomes very soft. But frankly, the solution, if you're going to do much nature photography, is a tripod. And on this trip with the National Outdoor Leadership School backpacking photography course, everybody carried one in addition to all everything else. And every night at 8:30, we get alpenglow. By the way, the best light here is between 6 and 7:15 in the morning, and unfortunately now, on this hill to the north of us. Okay, depth of field. Definition, zone of acceptable sharpness. By the way, this is with a telephoto lens, which doesn't have much depth of field, at probably f4, which is a big opening, therefore not much depth of field. Watch the background, exactly the same scene as I switch from f4 at probably a 30th of a second to f16 at 1 second. Foreground, no change at all, right? But look how the zone of sharpness has increased. By the way, this is just a cap tape, right? Funny, don't worry about the composition here. I'm trying to show depth of field. Notice the lower left, where everything else tends to fall away. This is about F4 again, F2.8. At a 30th, a 60th, somewhere in there. And we switch to F22. Much more depth. And of course, to me, this is the more appropriate photograph because it shows the seas and their little parachutes. One more, or two more examples. This lovely trumpet-shaped flower, which is a little washed out, unfortunately. But F2, go to F16. In this case, maybe not so good, because look at all that clutter in the upper right-hand corner. Now that's distracting for me. A few more examples. Guess what was behind this? I shot it with my macro 55mm lens. I'm very close to the subject. There's all the sticks and clutter and everything. But with minimizing depth of field, with like F2, you can get rid of that. Look at the back leaf at the bottom in there. See how it's already getting soft? It's probably maybe only an inch of depth of field. Just enough. Whoa, what happened?
What? Okay.
Over. Yeah. Washed out. All right. We'll go back and look at those depth of field shots in just a second, but let's get some lights. I have an exercise for you to take home with you on depth of field with text references, so you can, you don't need to take notes if you don't want to right now. But there are three factors that affect depth of field, and we've just reviewed two of them pretty well. First of all, f-stop, or aperture. And again, we can range from f2, right, down to f64. And in fact, Ansel Adams and a whole group of other people in the 30s belonged to a club called the f64 Club. I actually think F. Stop Fitzgerald was the charter member of that, right? Anyway, which is the big opening and which is the small opening? I'm giving you a clue. Right, very tiny opening. And a way to remember this, if you get out in the field and you can't remember, which would you rather have? 1/2 of a pie, if you're really hungry, or 1/64th, or 1/22nd, or 1/16th. That's a way to remember depth of field from f-stop, by that fraction. Most people think bigger the number, right? The bigger the opening. That's not true. So f-stop will minimize or maximize depth of field. Which gives the maximum?
The smaller the opening.
So we're talking f16 typically, or even 11 to 22 for most of your cameras. Excluding
so
the automatic.
Gets depth of field. What you're trying to do is shut it down and slow it down.
And of course, to compensate for these small openings,
you have to slow down.
Yeah, let me give you an example. F22 at, what is it, 1/4, okay, will actually work out. And to minimize depth of field, F2, You need to compensate by the difference in exposure, F-16, F-1.8, F-11, F-1.15, F-8, F-1.30, F-5.6, F-1.60, F-4, F-1.15, F-2.8, F-1.250, did it right. F-2 at 1,500. You see, if you're hand-holding, you also go through a problem, though, as you attempt, right? Let's say you're shooting, your light meter says aperture priority or whatever. Anyway, your light meter says, yeah, 1/500 at F-2 sounds good to me, and you click, what have you just done? You've minimized depth of field, but you've also frozen all the action. Great tool. But you remember this class and you maximize depth of field. So you keep going and your light meter, or you can, you get past the 30th to 1/4, 1/8. And if we give you an example here of 1/2 of a second, you can't even think about hand holding that. Or if there's a breeze and things are moving, you'll have a blur. So this is where the tripod enters in. Or you, as a handheld photographer, must stop here at a 30th or a 60th, or start bracing yourself. By the way, let me again repeat the demonstration. Most people shoot like this with a terrible, terrible problem of hand motion. Create a platform, vertically or horizontally. All right, if you don't, you're going to get hand shot. So let's switch quickly then. What are the other factors that affect depth of field? What's another one? Okay, right here, distance to subject. Now with a 50 millimeter normal lens, and this is agony for us Americans, especially Scandinavians, 2 feet away, how much depth of field would I have at, let's say, F2, just his nose or just his eyes. And by the way, in nature, wildlife, or people portraiture, always focus on the eyes, wildlife, or people. Even if the rest is out of focus, then at least it sort of looks sharp, if the eyes are sharp. And he hates this, so he says, move back to 5 feet. And stay at F2, but of course I've changed the composition. Now how much depth of field would I have? About 3.5 inches, which would get from the nose to the ear, which would make a nice portrait, because the rest would blur out behind you, right? Very little depth of field. And by the way, when we all get together and can turn on the lights, you actually have, most of you, a depth of field chart next to your f-stop ring on your focusing thing, and we'll talk about that. So we illustrated, by the way, if I were to be shooting the same scene at F-16 from 2 feet, I would have probably 2 inches or so. And back at 5 feet, I would have over 1 foot. So there is a huge impact, and we'll look at those slides again. The third factor, after we get our little notes up, the closer you are, the nearer you are, the less depth of field, the more distant you are, the greater the depth of field. Now, which lens would give you the maximum depth of field? A wide angle or a telephoto? Lisa?
Wide angle.
Yeah, and you've had some experience with that, right? By the way, wide angle lenses, as a result of that appearance, because of that maximizing depth of field, tend to make things look very sharp everywhere. Lots of depth of field, even when it's not sharp. But they just give you lots more depth of field. But quickly, what's a characteristic problem of wide-angle lenses, Lisa?
It just distorts everything.
Halloween faces, you're getting close, okay.
Too much foreground, that's the.
Yeah, well, that's nice sometimes. What happens to the trees and buildings with wide angle lenses? They start tilting in typically if you're leaning back. If you're leaning forward, they will tilt this way.
From a practical standpoint, that does that become a consideration if you're talking about a 35mm lens or a 28mm lens?
Yeah, it does. It's a huge difference.
It's obvious in a 16mm lens, but.
A 35mm wide angle lens has much more depth of field than a 50 or normal lens, alright?
But how about the distortion?
Distortion is the.
28mm lens, now we didn't take a lot of, we took mostly mountain shots.
Right.
And so we were not, if there was distortion, we weren't able to appreciate it.
You have to have vertical lens relatively close to see it.
I did a lot of testing when I bought my first one and I found out that if you go to a 28, you really don't risk a whole lot of distortion. Once you drop below 28, then it starts to show.
It really will show. The key thing is to keep this back parallel to whatever's vertical. For example, if I were shooting this room with my 24mm wide angle, the instant I tilt it slightly, those poles are going to do this. So we learned an aesthetic length though, maximum depth of field linked to a distorting effect. It will curve. And of course, a fisheye lens is ridiculous. It doesn't even look like what you're looking at. So, what will minimize then a depth of field?
Telephoto.
A telephoto, and you will see effects at approximately 135. By the way, the best portraiture lens of all is somewhere between 80 to 110, a zoom. And the reason is because an 80mm lens renders almost perfect dimensions in terms of flattening or distorting. A telephoto, even though it's giving you less depth of field, will do what to a subject? It will smash things together front to back. Remember those cattails? That was with the telephoto. Those things were, the front to back were actually quite far apart. And we'll look at some more of those again and talk about it. So a telephoto, those of you who carry around an 80 to 200 zoom, first of all, you've got to worry about handheld problems, right? And you're also suffering from not very much depth of field. Suffering only if you're not aware. Depth of field on my telephoto is no problem for me because I carry my tripod for all of my nature work. And with my telephoto lens, I'm shooting typically, because it's a slow lens, right? It's only an f2.8 or f3.5, something like that. I'm typically shooting half second, fourth of a second, eighth of a second, 15th of a second, 30th of a second on the tripod. And I'm using either my cable release, by the way, or the timer. Because if you jab at your camera when it's on a tripod and just shut it, use the shutter that way, you're going to jerk it around. The timer or a cable release is mandatory with tripod. So let's work our way through this again in terms of depth of field and shutter speed. First of all, let's conceptualize. F2 at 1/500 gives me what in terms of depth of field? F2.
Not a shallow.
Yeah, it's a big opening in terms of f-stop. 1/500 though is doing what aesthetically to the action? The jargon is freezing. Okay. Now that could be the perfect photograph. And let's assume, by the way, that that's the absolutely dead perfect exposure. The red shirt is saturated. All right, everything in terms of exposure is correct. we've switched all the way to F22 at F14, or at 1/4, excuse me. Is the exposure still all right?
Don't know.
Okay, anybody? Has the exposure changed at all? Is the red shirt still beautiful and shadow detail and the highlights are all still wonderful? Absolutely. But what have we changed dramatically? Have you been able to follow what we're doing? Well, with F22 in terms of depth of field, what has changed? Okay, Lisa?
Lots of depth of field.
Lots of depth of field. Much, much more. But, Lisa or anybody, at 1/4 of a second?
You're going to have a blur.
Yeah. Okay, and you also have to have it on a tripod. But it's a perfect exposure. It's just a matter of subject matter now, isn't it? It's a matter of subject matter. What do you want to show? And that's up to you. Let me reassure all of you again at this point. You now know more about photography than 90% of everybody carrying a camera. And it only took us 45 minutes, though an hour for the rest of you the other day. Literally, you now know more than 90% of everybody carrying a camera. The problem is if you have a PhD light meter camera that you can't override to manual. Now, Jonathan has a shutter speed priority camera. Okay, you see what you could do, Jonathan? You could switch from either 500th to 1/4, and the light meter will pick either F22 or F2 for you, so you can manipulate depth of field with your half automatic light meter. Do it and demonstrate to yourself that you can control that. You need to gain control of your cameras. And you do that first with the light meter. You had a comment, question?
Yeah. One technique, and I was just thinking of something, it wasn't something I do, I think it was something my wife was doing. But if you got a situation where you want a subject and you want to literally cut the garbage out and back, then, right. Then what you ought to be doing is taking it slower, quicker, and blurring the back.
I think you're referring to panning, perhaps?
I don't know. It's just trying to capture a subject without all the garbage behind it.
Remember the guy with the sprinkler growing out of his head? Okay, that was because of maximum depth of field. What would change that image? Yeah, you have to change f-stops and shutter speeds down to a point where you would increase the shutter speed to compensate for the wider aperture, and soon that would just be a blur back then. Imagine, I'll use you as a portrait with lots of depth of field. I've got, looks like a timer and a wall board growing right out of the back of your head, all right? Two things I could do. Not changing anything on the camera, but moving closer, change the composition, right? I could also stand here and switch to which lens? A telephoto lens, which will, again, make it appear as if I've moved close. Or I could, even standing here, and this is always scary, I could go to a different, wider f-stop. Always check, make sure that goes on. All right. By the way, there's a couple other techniques that you should learn about in terms of shutter speed, and especially if you have an awful background. I was looking at those little kids out there on those carts. I gotta get a photograph of them. Anyway, it's called panning. If you have a cluttered background and you don't want the panning, you can pan with the subject at a slow shutter speed, like 15th, or an eighth of a second, trying to keep a parallel plane, and it comes from the movies, by the way, panning, right? However, this is what most people do with panning. What have you just done? Well, you've
stopped there.
You stopped the blur of the background. However, if you pan with those little kids on those bikes at a, like an eighth of a second as they go by in a level plane, you will partially freeze their action, slight blur, but the background will be the streak. It's a great technique. Practice. And if we can still get the insurance paid up on your kids, we'll keep doing that, right? Panning.
So that, just to review that,
slow shutter speed?
Slow shutter speed, and you said it was 15th and an
8th? 15th or an 8th, something like that.
But you just 30th? Keep going.
You have to keep going.
And that's going to, the amount of blur on the, that you get in the picture from the subject is going to depend on how accurately you pan, right? How closely, theoretically, the camera is aimed at a point on a moving object.
Yes.
If you can keep on that target while you pan, then there should be no motion.
And let's think it through one more factor, one more variable, if we'd like to. What about panning from back here on something way back there? It doesn't work, because you get so much depth of field from back here. You need to pan with subjects that are relatively
close. Well, let's just pursue the example you were just talking about. Where, Ian is whipping down the driveway at 90 miles an hour in his gravel flying.
Right.
Where would you stand, on the side of the road?
I would stand behind the truck, so he wouldn't hit me about this, so he would come within 8 to 10 feet away from me and pan it in just like that. And the chalets would just be a blur of grass and wood and everything.
I can't wait to try that in winter. One of the best shots we've got of our kids is on a sled coming down
sure.
the hill.
Sure.
But I didn't, it was just what you said, what most people do. I froze, I just clicked it and it's just a frozen picture, but there's no blurred background.
And let's go back to the freezing idea, all right? The closer you are to a subject that's moving, even walking, what do you have to do? Use a faster shutter speed, or you will get a blur. Your automatic camera's just, you're stuck with your camera gift. But flash will help. Flash will freeze things much more, because it goes off at a 10,000th of a second. So another way to freeze action is to move back a little bit. And that will help freeze things.
One other question, this may confuse the issue here.
Yeah.
But it's from your experience, if you're trying to do all this, and you got some options, because there's so much range in both print and slide film now, directions in terms of ASA,
let's review ASA again quickly, because it's a crucial element in aesthetic quality of your image. Too many people are using high ASA film. Why? Because it allows you to handheld under low light conditions. But most high ASA slide film, let's just talk about slide film, once you're above 100 ASA, has narrow latitude or ability to capture high light and shadow detail. Kodachrome 25 has the best, widest latitude. Remember we talked about that river scene with the people under the umbrella? Latitude refers to the ability to capture shadow detail to highlight detail. In that scene, you literally have to give up one or the other, because the shadow is more than three, in that case it's about five stops from the highlight detail. Many of you are shooting film, print film, which actually gives you more latitude the higher the ASA. It's just the reverse of slide. But most of you are shooting in contrasty light, like that umbrella scene or out in front today, shooting face on into people. And your film is washing out the white area. And Lisa, just to use you as an example, your hair would wash out if I captured the color and nicely in your sweater. If I got your face and hair right, your sweater would be dark. Because in bright sunshine, the latitude of the film can't do that. So you give up something with higher ASAs and slides, but you, if you're shooting prints, that's okay. Except you still get a harsher color quality, and what happens to the grain molecules as you go up in ASA or ISA?
White grain.
Yeah, pretty soon they're about apple size. Three of them make up somebody's face, and that's not very attractive. Lisa, you had a question or comment.
With that picture of those people in the river, whatever, are you saying that with ASA 25 you wouldn't have a strong contrast so much?
No.
So what
I'm saying with ASA 25 slide film, it has the widest latitude, and it would get the most.
It would get the contrast as well as the detail?
No, it didn't in that scene, because that scene has probably 5 to 6 stops difference between the highlight to the shadow detail. So let's review this issue of PhD metering again. Most people are composing the scene, and they use all sorts of things that we'll talk about on Thursday, like rule of thirds. That looks nice. They read the meter and shoot it. Unfortunately, maybe with color slides, the area that they really wanted to meter off in terms of rendition was here. And so you have to meter off the brightest area that you want detail in with slide. And then you go back and compose. Unless you have a camera that constantly reads the exposure and you can't freeze the light meter reading, or if you have a manual camera like this, or like yours, perfect for this technique. Meter off what you want rendered accurately and then go back and compose. Or if that's too dangerous to get close, well, let's see, that chair is about the same tone quality as the ground over here, so I'll just meter off down here.
Well,
and then, shoot.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Say a skier on a slope, and you don't have an opportunity, obviously, to meter off the skier
Going
down.
Meter off a friend standing in the same location. The problem you'll have with a skier on snow is
the snow.
Gray snow, if you just are metering off the person. So what I recommend, if you truly want white snow in the scene, is shoot, meter off the snow, and then do what? Overexpose slightly. And forget the colorful skier who will show up vibrantly.
Yeah. You said a half or a full skier.
Right.
Did you do one or the other?
I'm with color 25, I only use a half.
Say Coke 64.
Anything like half.
Half.
100 or more go. But what you need to do is to practice. You need to shoot some practice film, and you need to try bracketing. You need to write in a diary what your exposures were, what the conditions were. And before we forget, because it's about 7:05. I would like you all, either up here or at home, to experiment using this text if you like, or just if you can figure out what this is saying. What can I go, it's 7:08, what can we go to safely? 7:20, is that all right for everybody?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have enough time then, I think. Let's skim through this. Remember, every year, replace that light meter battery, or you're going to have problems. First paragraph. And remember, as someone didn't do Sunday when he was out in that beautiful, flat, God's umbrella light, as opposed to this harsh, bright stuff, get the correct ISO ASA rating on your camera. I took two shots before I remembered. My camera has a little memory device in the back near the top of the bog. All right. There's actually a way, a little memory rule. If your light meter ever breaks down, the correct exposure for walking out in the sunshine today was actually F16 at 1 over the ASA. And in the Fuji film boxes, there's still a sheet of paper. In the Kodak boxes, it's printed on the inside, is this magic sunshine rule. Only they don't tell you that it's F16 at 1 over the ASA. They give you in German, French, Italian, Japanese. They say, I can't read Spanish. Bright sunlight, 1/250th at F11 for Fuji 100, which is actually is that the same? Let's take a look. If I used the magic rule, it'd be F16 at 1/125th. Well, guess what? It's exactly right. Fuji doesn't lie to us. The trouble is guessing when it's actually a hazy or cloudy day. So you're welcome to experiment with that on page 19 in the text. Bracketing, then in number 2, go half stop over and under. Attempt the freeze action. These are exercises that are good for all of you. It's fun to try, even with your automatic camera. Use the flash, though, to freeze some action, too, sometimes. And then number 4, intentionally bracket overexposure and underexposure, and you'll see what type of latitude you have, Lisa. In whatever film you're using. Remember to go from contrasty light to subdued light, though, to see the difference there. And page 22 for that rule of thumb in the text, meter off the brightest area with slides that you want exposed. With print film, we typically meter off the shadow area where we want detail. I didn't say that earlier. With print film, we typically meter off the shadows.
Meter off the shadows.
For print film.
For slides.
If you want detail in the shadows, if you want detail in the bright areas, meter off the bright areas.
For slide film, is it the opposite?
For slide film, you meter off whatever area you want.
Oh, okay.
Correct. The problem with print film is that your light meters typically will underexpose contrasty scenes in the shadow area, and it turns it dark, and use the backlight. Now for a depth of field exercise, and I apologize for the 2 sheets of paper, everything else in this class is back to back. And if you don't want to keep these, just leave them in this room and I'll pick them up.
Okay, good.
Did we get enough?
Oh.
This says using your tripod. You do not need a tripod to maximize or minimize your depth of field. But remember to stay close to your subject to see the most effect. If you're far away with your prints or your slides, what have you done? You've pretty much counterbalanced the change in f-stop.
Mark, yes. Is there just one sheet on the depth of field?
Yeah, right. Now, if you have more than one lens or a zoom lens, change lenses and shoot the same scene. Wide angle, telephoto. That's a very nice, but of course you're attempting to keep the same relative composition in the scene, and that's hard at the same time. Thursday, we're going to look at composition, and there's so many artistic aspects to composition that ultimately each of you have a vision, and you should go for that vision, whatever is right. But too much of your work is centered, because that's where the light meter is, right? You've composed and metered off the object and smack dab in the middle. It's boring. Eye level work, boring. To our visually trained eyes, we've looked at images since we were babies. Photography is 151 years old. And there are many boring kinds of images, including centered and eye level work. You can immediately get rid of that. One of the techniques for rule of thirds, just for example, there's a focusing ring in most of your lenses. Out on the outer edge of that ring inside the image is about where the rule of thirds. So put flowers, put people's faces out of that rule of thirds. On Thursday, we'll talk much more about that. There's some Thursday night stuff down here at the bottom. A whole list of ideas for composition, things to look for. Texture, for example. Dominant foreground. Then work on portraits, designs, patterns. Would it help if we looked at those depth of field slides again one time, just so anybody care to do that? Or should we answer questions?
Yeah. Mark, you were talking about print film. I didn't quite understand what you thought was optimum.
Okay, I would stay away from the high ASA. I'd never answered that question clearly, or at all. Stay away from high ASA 400 and above. Never go above 400. And if you're tired of the way your 400 prints look, because they're contrasted, they're washed out, do two things. One, don't shoot in contrasted light. Wait for subdued light, like clouds, or switch to backlighting. And then try some lower ASA, 100.
What would be, we use the Kodak Gold.
Right, that's what you use, 100.
But right. Now, would there be any advantage to using a slower print film for mountain scenes?
I wouldn't. I would use Ektar 100, which has marvelous grain size. It's incredible. For any of you who are using print film and you want really crisp, sharp images, assuming you're using a fast enough shutter speed, right? Switch to the Ektar. But for most consumer level work, when you're not ever blowing it up beyond the 3x5, 4x6, etc., stay with the 100s, the 200s. The 400s will increase the contrast in the scene, and they will increase the grain. But if you're close to the subject, if you're sharply focused, not a horrible problem, really. Those of us shooting color slides consistently in nature do so for one reason. It's the only thing you can sell, market. Yeah. Magazines, calendars.
That's because it's easier for them to...
Yeah, they need the transparency, the positive film, to make the color separation. And as I say, this is an expensive hobby.
But taking slides is less expensive than making prints.
Yeah, but it's terribly frustrating, right?
Those you can't carry them around.
Hey, you can't carry them around and show them to your friends pretty easily if that projector doesn't fit. Yeah, a couple other issues. It gets expensive, you know, to make prints from the slides. But you have to compromise.
Mark, a real quick trick. I learned this 3 years ago when I took a trip to Australia, and I basically shot slides the whole trip, except I did take some print.
Good.
Because I was gonna be with family, and I thought, well, I don't want slides here, I want, you know, I can shoot a bunch of shots, so I can run copies off here, but... Well, I try to plan quite a ways ahead, and I always have a couple extra rolls. Well, I got in a situation where I really got carried away, and I got right down, we still have a real neat part of the trip left, and all I had was print film. So, I wasn't with, missed the shot, so I shot prints. And, I had, Kit's camera does a magnificent job of shooting, of making slides from prints.
Good.
So that you, I've seen some people do it and they're terrible. But you, they do a job that you can't tell a difference. So if I get it, if I'm in a situation, like I, the camera I'm using now, I use for work. And I basically want prints, so I shoot all prints with this thing. Then I go through my prints because I'm putting together a slide presentation to go with the project. Call out the ones I want to make, and then I just get slides made.
That's the first time I've ever heard anybody other than a truly professional lab being satisfied with that type of work. But give it a try. You have to. What was the brand? The company? Kit?
Kits.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, they're in all the malls. They do a fantastic job.
Scott?
Well, what about, there's a wide variety of different kinds of film on the market.
Right.
You see specials and all kinds of
Right, stuff. Let's talk quickly about that. We know about ASA and bigger grain size, but Ektachrome also has a serious bluish tint to it in color slides for my eye. I don't like it. I use Kodachrome. For two reasons. One is it's permanent, it will last forever, unlike Ektachrome, which also kind of wears out over 10 years or so, especially when you project them. So you got to be careful with Ektachrome. Those of you who shot Ektachrome maybe years ago, anybody here, 20 years ago?
Some that I took 30 years ago.
If you're not careful, it's gone, especially if it's been out in the light at all.
It used to be really bad for reds in the 50s too, I don't know if that's anymore.
Kodachrome, to my eye, 64-25 was the best rendition in color, but I'm blue hypersensitive, just born that way. A friend of mine loved it, and he sells his work all the time with Ektachrome, though he has now switched to this magic Japanese green box. Fuji 100 is wonderful.
Well, it has a lot of green in it.
Used to.
Oh, it doesn't.
Used
to. We shot a couple rolls of Fuji slide film in 1973 and 74,
right.
And it was terrible.
It was awful.
Did
you ever drive a early Datsun? Same caliber. Yeah. F-Stop Fitzgerald wouldn't use that early Fuji at all, but he loves Fuji 100, and the Professional 50 is incredibly good. Yeah. Now, in terms of print film, if we switch back, so virtually I'm saying no Ektachrome. I cannot recommend it for any purpose. Any.